I'm Steve Norman reporting. China said Sunday talks with the U.S. on trade have been positive, with concrete progress after 2 days of trade talks in Beijing involving U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. He described the talks as friendly and frank. Larry Kudlow, President Trump's chief economic advisor, appeared on Fox News Sunday.
All these negotiations take time. Everything's on the table during the negotiations, but you can't expect you're not going to change Rome in a day, and I think that's a very realistic attitude.
Kudlow says the talks continue and praised Mr. Trump for being bold in confronting China on their trade disagreements. Meantime, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau challenged the U.S. decision to impose tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum imports. It happened in an appearance on the NBC program Meet the Press.
The fact that the president has moved forward with these tariffs is not just going to hurt Canadian jobs, it's going to hurt U.S. jobs as well. And neither of those things is something that Canada wants to see.
Trudeau dismissed as insulting and unacceptable the view that Canadian products pose a national security threat and is threatening to retaliate. Kudlow called that an overreaction, insisting this is not an attack on Canada. He said both sides appear willing to continue talks on matters like intellectual property. Nearly 50 migrants, mostly from Tunisia, drowned Sunday when their overcrowded boat sank off the Tunisian coast. Dozens of others rescued. The boat, described as large enough for 90 people, had twice as many. Separately, 9 people, including 6 children, died Sunday after their boat with 15 sank off the Turkish coast. This is VOA News. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif is calling the United States pullout from the nuclear deal illegal and urging other signatories, Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia, to make up for the Iranian losses brought on by the U.S. withdrawal. President Trump says the agreement would allow Iran to resume some of its nuclear programs in the next decade. He said it also does nothing to rein in Iran's ballistic missile program or its support for extremists in the Middle East. He also threatened to impose sanctions on Tehran. North Korean state media reporting that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is preparing to visit North Korea, although no date was mentioned and there was no confirmation from Damascus. If so, it is believed to be the first state visit under leader Kim Jong-un and comes amid preparations for an unprecedented U.S.-North Korea summit. Meantime, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis has attempted to dial back expectations for any talks between the United States and North Korea.
We can anticipate at best a bumpy road to the negotiations. As defense ministers, we must maintain a strong, collaborative, defensive stance so we enable our diplomats to negotiate from a calm position of strength in this critical time.
Trump-Kemp summit is set to take place June 12th in Singapore. A week before Sicilian municipal elections, leaders of Italy's new populist coalition government appeared at political rallies after the Five Star Movement and Northern League entered office on Friday. The new Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, encountered protesters at a migrant detention center demanding that he go away. He said he intends to work to reduce the number of people arriving and increase the number of deportations. The New York City Police Department took no chances with the Celebrate Israel parade in light of recent tensions overseas. Police said Sunday there were no specific threats. Michael Rosenzweig of the Jewish National Fund says he is honored to be a longtime supporter of the parade.
I've been taking part in the parade probably about since I was a kid, so close to about 50 years. And it's special to show the support for the state of Israel and the people of Israel every day with what they're going through from their neighboring countries and what goes on in Israel. And we're here to support them.
The Sunday Israel Day Parade marked the 70th anniversary of the founding of Israel. Get more news at our website. You can find us at voanews.com. I'm Steve Norman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning. Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, June 4th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. IGAD says June 30th deadline for South Sudan's two warring party leaders to meet. But first, the rebels want their leaders released.
We are optimistic that Dr. Riek Machar, once released, he can make critical contribution to the peace and the resolution of conflict in South Sudan.
General Onyet Nathaniel Pierino is the head of the governing team for South Sudan rebels. Zimbabwe President Mnangagwa opens a three-day investment summit in Harare today, Monday. Uganda's main opposition candidate wins a crucial parliamentary by-election. And a Malawi media group continues to publish despite an order to close for tax evasion.
We have a TV, we have a radio station, we have newspapers that publish every day. So we continue to publish because we think we have a duty to the people of Malawi.
George Kasikula is editor-in-chief of the privately owned Times Group of Malawi. Three people are dead in Kenya after a three-story building collapse. And Africa Fashion and Cultural Week expands beyond Europe and into the African countries. Those stories plus Samse Omale's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An official of South Sudan's main rebel group, loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar, says whoever is holding Mr. Machar in South Africa must release him immediately to enable him participating in any meaningful peace talks. This comes as the regional body, Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, has set a June 30th deadline for face-to-face talks between President Salva Kiir and Mr. Machar. A communique issued last Friday by IGAD foreign ministers meeting in Ethiopia called on President Kiir and Mr. Machar to resolve their differences for the good of the citizens of South Sudan. Major General Onyet Nathaniel Pierino is the head of the rebel governing team. He says the IGAD move is a welcome development, one that would foster peace. But first, he said Mr. Machar must be released.
The IGAD Council of Ministers, they met and decided on a number of issues, including a recommendation that Dr. Riek Machar and President Salva Kiir should meet face-to-face in Mauritania. This is a welcome development. We feel that this will foster peace and boost the peace process.
When you say it's a welcome development, are you saying that Mr. Riek Machar might be able to attend?
We want Dr. Riek Machar to be freed from South Africa, where he's being exiled. IGAD made a resolution which called for face-to-face meeting between Dr. Riek Machar and President Salva Kiir. So we welcome this.
This decision by IGAD is coming on the heels of the United Nations Security Council postponing its vote on whether to impose additional sanctions on you. Talk to me first. Is there a concern by SPLMIO that the international community is getting frustrated with both sides in South Sudan?
It is not frustration with the SPLMIO. We have committed ourselves to the peace process. We have sent delegates to Addis Ababa, and we signed cessation of hostilities, and we observe the agreement on cessation of hostilities. It is the government which is in transition. It is the government which is not negotiating in good faith. And we want the international community to give pressure on the government to break the intransigence so that they can negotiate in good faith, so that they can honor agreements, including the cessation of hostilities and humanitarian access.
You're talking about negotiating in good faith. The government will say that, in fact, that's what the government has said, that you, the rebels, are not negotiating in good faith. As a result, the government has threatened that it will probably hold elections because it feels you're not serious about negotiations.
It is the government that is negotiating in bad faith. They have placed a number of conditions, including the continuous detention of Dr. Riek Machar. They call for the exclusion of Dr. Riek Machar from the transitional government of national unity.
You mentioned the continued detention of Riek Machar. The government of South Sudan has said it has nothing to do with Riek Machar being in South Africa.
It is the government that created the situation in Juba in 2016. They attacked the residents of Dr. Riek Machar.
Major General Onyet Nathaniel Pierino is the head of the rebel governing team. He was speaking with me from Uganda's capital, Kampala. Lawyers for the privately owned Times Group of Malawi will try again today, Monday, to serve a court order on the Malawi Revenue Authority to vacate the premises of the media group. The Times Group owns newspapers and a radio and television station, but the Revenue Authority last Friday ordered the everything closed over accumulated tax arrears. Editor-in-Chief George Kasakula says the group has been paying their taxes. He says the media is being targeted because of its criticism of government. But Information Minister Nicholas Dahusi says the closure is strictly about taxes and not about failure to pay taxes. Editor-in-Chief Kasakula says the media group is being treated unfairly.
We do, but the law is very, very clear that when you owe taxes, it's not like the very first day when the revenue authority says you need to pay, then you pay. There's a discussion. You can negotiate and say, okay, yes, we owe the bill, but probably we're able to pay maybe after 2-3 months. That is allowed in the law. We're not given that luxury that others have. So that's where the problem is. The problem is not about the bill. The problem is about how the revenue authority can get that bill.
I was reading that you believe that the closure of your paper is linked to your criticism of the government.
Yes, that's correct. That's the issue. It's not about tax, because we have certain organizations in the country that have much more tax than us, maybe 10 times, 20 times. But they're not treated the same way we are treated. The public broadcaster, Malawi Broadcasting Corporation, owes the tax authority over lots of money, $4 billion in Malawi kwacha. That's lots of dollars. They even went to Parliament asking for Parliament to write off the bill. But with us, it's less than that. But they still come to ask us in that draconian way. So it's not about tax, I think. It's about the declaration. It's about what we do every day. It's about trying to fight so that we don't stand up for them, don't stand up for Malaya.
I just spoke with the Minister of Information, Nicholas Dahusi. He really believes that...
Yes.
This is not about press freedom. In fact, he says that Malawi enjoys press freedom. This is just about the failure of your organization to pay taxes.
Not necessarily. In fact, for the past 90 days, my company has paid lots of tax to government. I think it was 80 million kwacha. So it's not correct to say we don't pay tax. We do pay tax. We're willing to pay tax. We're a responsible, law-abiding corporate citizen who wants to pay their taxes. It's just that we're treated different from others. So it's not about tax. I think the issue is about them trying to silence the voice of the people who we stand for.
George, I'm reading that one of your papers did publish on Saturday, and you continue to publish.
Yes, we continue to publish because we think we have a duty to the country to make sure that they read us, they hear from us. We have a TV, we have a radio station, we have newspapers that publish every day. So we continue to publish because we think we have a duty to the people of Malawi. We are publishing through the help of others. We are not using our machines, our offices are closed, but we still managed to come out. It's not defiance, but I think we have a duty to the people.
It's so nice to talk with you, and thank you very much again for being on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you very much. Great. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
George Kasakula is editor-in-chief of the privately owned Times Group of Malawi. He was speaking with me from the capital, Blantyre. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, June 4th. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa is expected to open a three-day investment summit in Harare today, Monday. Expected also to attend is the British Trade Commissioner for Africa in the Department of International Trade, as well as business executives from the United Kingdom, United States, and other developed nations. President Mnangagwa has said that Zimbabwe is open for business following the ouster last November of longtime ruler Robert Mugabe by the military. Independent economic commentator Rejoice Ngwenya said the investors' summit is critical for Zimbabwe, which is gearing up for a presidential election at the end of July this year.
The president has been talking a lot about Zimbabwe being open for business, and it's very critical that he continues momentum by playing host to these business individuals that come from outside the country, because the only way you can be able to test his integrity and his promises by coming to Zimbabwe and looking at the environment yourself and experiencing the texture of the business environment.
So it seems as if the British are sending really some very high-profile people. What does this mean, Mr. Ngwenya?
Well, we know that ever since Mnangagwa took over, he has been courting and luring the British business people, and it's very important that the legacy of British business in Zimbabwe be continued because of the high standards. So I believe, I truly believe that the British investor is really interested in Zimbabwe. It's a very integral part of the African subcontinent, and it's critical that they themselves, you know, respond to these apertures because they are good for any government that's going to come into office.
Is this not an election gimmick or something like that?
It could be. You see, when an incumbent government is doing things during elections, we always tend to consider it as an election gimmick. But let's put it this way. Any investment that comes into the country now, it's very important even for the future government. So an investment doesn't take, it's not done over a period of 2 or 3 months. It's a long-term thing. So I feel that whoever is going to be victorious in the next elections, the processes of attracting foreign businesses are very critical. Of course, everybody and every political party that's going to rule requires foreign direct investment for this country.
Which business sectors do you think need a lot of foreign direct investment?
Well, what we are looking at, Zimbabwe is wasting millions of dollars importing commodities that are consumed in industry and in the homes and in the commercial sector. So I believe the manufacturing sector, look, the mining industry is well covered. I mean, there are billions of dollars worth of investment in the mining industry already. So I really strongly feel that the industries that produce commodities for export and those that add value to commodities like minerals and agricultural products are very critical for investment growth. What is the point of talking about FDI if it's not export-based? So I believe, really, the conductive sector is very critical in this trajectory of FDI.
That was Rejoice Ngwenya, an independent economic commentator, speaking with Gibbs Dube of US Zimbabwe Service. Former Ugandan presidential candidate Dr. Chisa Besigye of the main opposition Forum for Democratic Change says the struggle in Uganda today is not one of policy platforms, but rather a struggle for the re-empowerment of the citizens to assert their influence. This comes after FDC candidate Betty Muzanira on Friday won a hotly contested Rukungiri woman-only parliamentary by-election over the candidate of the ruling National Resistance Movement. Dr. Besigye says it is time to empower the people because no Ugandan leader has ever taken power through an election but through military means.
First of all, you have to understand that elections in Uganda are far from being free or fair. As you know, Mr. Museveni captured power not through elections, through force of arms, and the power is essentially still held by the military. And so there is a struggle for democratization. We go to every election knowing that it's an unfree and an unfair election. And so in spite of all that, I'm glad that our people are becoming empowered, assertive.
Dr. Besigye, you mentioned the amount of money that was spent. My understanding is there was money spent on both sides. Are you saying that the government spent more money just to get their candidate to win?
Absolutely. Not just more money. I mean, as I have told you, just before the election, Mr. Museveni came and spent about $5 billion worth of donations. This is state money. This is public money, taxpayers' money. Secondly, there was massive bribing of voters. So this is not in question. There is nowhere we can get money ourselves to engage in such things, even if we wanted to do so. And certainly it's illegal to do so. The whole campaign that we conducted was to empower people, eat that money brought by the regime, the NRM junta, and to vote against it. That was the main thrust of the campaign.
Ms. Betty Muzanira, the candidate that won for your party, she's a female. What does this say about the candidates? Does it mean that your party needs to take a look at candidates that you field as you move forward? I mean, younger, maybe diversified candidates?
Well, first of all, this seat that was being contested is an affirmative action seat. It's a seat that is competed for only by women. It's called the woman seat. Every district elects a woman who competes only with women. So So this was that type of seat. That's why all the candidates were women. Yes, the profile of our voters is that we have a very young population. In fact, we have a population of children because more than half of the country's population is below 15 years. So yes, it is helpful to have younger candidates. But again, as I have told you, the struggle now is not really a struggle of the policy platforms. It's not a struggle of the type of candidates because it's not an election. The struggle we are engaged in is a struggle for democratic space. It's a struggle for re-empowerment of citizens who have influence in their country. Don't forget, in Uganda since independence, no leader has ever taken power through an election. Every leader booms their way into office, and every leader is bombed out of office.
Dr. Chisa Besigye is the former presidential candidate for Uganda's main opposition forum for democratic change. She was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Three people were killed and many wounded in Kenya after a three-story building collapsed on Sunday. Reporter Maureen Ojiambo joins us now with details from Nairobi.
So far, three people have been confirmed dead and seven others injured in the building that collapsed early morning on Sunday. It's a five-story building that collapsed in Nairobi's Huruma Estate. So far, two of those who died are said to be a man and a wife who are living in a structure adjacent to the ill-fated building that collapsed while one person, a male victim, was retrieved dead from the rumbles. And according to the National Disaster Management Unit, the building was among the many who were marked unsafe for accommodation, and that among those who deceased were 12 families who had not relocated and they were living in that building illegally.
So, Maureen, was this an apartment building or what?
Yes, it is an apartment, a five-story building in Huruma Estate in Nairobi.
Did you say the building was one of those marked unsafe to reside in, and why did people live in it?
Yes, early late last year in December 2017, that is, the National Construction Authority marked the building as unsafe, but people still lived in that building. That's according to the report by the National Construction Authority, but the building had been marked X, not for accommodation, but some people still lived in the building. They say that was very unsafe for people to live, to be accommodated inside. And then there are still other buildings that are around, surrounded by the same building, and we still have people inside, and they are also marked as unsafe for people to live inside, for accommodation, rather.
I wanted to see if you can give me a few remarks on this. Is there a leadership now for the opposition, National Super Alliance, NASA? I was reading that Kalonzo Musyoka has said that he's not going to take over the leadership. Is there a leadership vacuum for this opposition?
So far, we've not had any, but we've just heard about the handshake and then the NASA opposition leader, Elodinga, Moses Wetangula, Musalia Mudavadi, and Kalonzo Musyoka, they have not been together of late, and they have not held any rally together as they were before the handshake that was then back in March.
Marie, thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you on Daybreak Africa.
Okay, thank you.
That's reporter Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya. Africa Fashion and Cultural Week is expanding its outreach beyond Europe into three African countries this year. While one of the countries where they are expected to put on a show is Equatorial Guinea, the founder, Diana Tambe, tells Ricky Schreier that their goal is to help the entire spectrum of African fashion.
Our brand and fashion houses and designers, we are not only focusing on the expansion or the innovation of African fashion designers, but we also empowering brands and designers, models, craftsmanship, highlighting the long-standing contribution of African fashion industry. To expand African fashion, textile and international trade for mentorship programs and artistic innovation empowerment.
A lot of African fashion uses materials and fabrics that come from other countries. So are you seeing a real movement toward African textiles being created? I mean, as you kind of mentioned, African fashion isn't just about designers. It's about this whole broad spectrum, I think, of industry and of business, from textiles to online shopping, etc.
Yes, but unfortunately, I don't know if you know that the biggest African textile trading industry is the Blisco were based in the Netherlands. So we're basically consuming foreign goods. This is not the idea.
That's Diana Tambe, founder of Africa Fashion and Cultural Week. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Malabo. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin with the 2018 FIFA World Cup, which is exactly 10 days away. Tunisia and Nigeria named their final 23-man squad at the end of their international friendlies this past weekend. For the Carthage Eagles of Tunisia, who drew 2-2 with Turkey, coach Nabil Maloul included Wahib Kaziri, who has battled to overcome a thigh injury over the last month, and fixed again midfielder Mohamed Amine Ben Amor in their final 23-man squad for the World Cup. For the Super Eagles of Nigeria, Chelsea defender Olaiyo and Boraspor midfielder Michael Agu will not be among those that will be going to the 2018 World Cup in Russia after Nigerian coach Gernot Rohr omitted them from his final 23-man squad for the tournament on Sunday. The Super Eagles had lost 2-1 to the Three Lions of England on Saturday in a warm-up game ahead of the World Cup at the Wembley Stadium. Staying with the World Cup, Egypt, one of the five African representatives to the World Cup, appears to be missing the team's star striker, Mohamed Salah. Coach Hector Cooper has admitted that Mo Salah's absence is affecting Egypt's World Cup preparations. Egypt have now gone 5 games without victory, stretching back to last October. Salah is still in doubt for Egypt's opening match in Group A on June 15th against Uruguay after suffering a shoulder injury in the Champions League final for Liverpool late last month. And on to Southern Africa, where Zimbabwe goalkeeper George Chiguva saved 3 penalties in the post-match shootout as the Warriors booked a semi-final place in the 2018 COSAFA Cup with a 4-1 victory that followed a tense 1-1 draw in the 90 minutes. Hosts South Africa were on the wrong end of a shootout result as they were ousted from the competition by Madagascar, who triumphed 4-3 on penalties after the match finished 0-0 in regulation time. It means that semi final lineup is complete, with defending champions Zimbabwe to take on Lesotho, while Zambia will clash with Madagascar. Both of those matches will be played at the new Peter Makoba Stadium on Wednesday. And now to athletics news. Over 60 Kenyan athletes are expected to take part in the 21st Senior African Athletics Championship to be staged in Asaba, Delta State, Nigeria, from August the 1st to the 5th. Athletics Kenya President Jack Tuwei said they will take the Asaba 2018 event seriously, since the top 2 runners from each discipline will qualify for the IWAF Continental Cup scheduled in Ostrava, the Czech Republic, on September the 8th to the 9th.
Thank you, and Samson. And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for joining us this week. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I am James Barton, Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good week.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impuga, the host of Reporters Roundtable. This week on Reporters Roundtable, a discussion of foreign aid and corruption in Africa. That's Reporters Roundtable this Thursday at 17:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we look at the heroic rescue of a child by a migrant from Mali and examine the forces that pushed him out of Africa and into Europe. What are the factors that propel people to leave their country? And why is Europe such an alluring destination? On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
is my